Hello, returning happies and new listeners. This is Steve Bennett Martin.
And this is Stephen Martin Bennett. And welcome to A Lifetime of Happiness,
the podcast where we take you on our journey through some of the movies, television shows, and other bits of pop culture that are helping keep us happy, while hopefully bringing a smile to your face along the way.
And today, we're going to be talking about season one of Downton Abbey with special guest all the way from France, Ronnie Diamond.
Yes, but before we get to that old queen, my love, what's making you happy?
Well, what's making me happy is that my girl, Jen Garner, has a new movie out, and it's called Yesterday, and we watched it, and I thought it was absolutely adorable and endearing.
Excellent, yes. Well, that, and certainly, I also think the idea of a yes day is something that would be fun to do sometime. Not that we normally say no to each other, but
right,
just a day where we push ourselves to say yes to more stuff we normally wouldn't say yes to or something.
Yeah.
But we're not going to be having any children anytime soon, so we'll give Remy a yes day.
Every day is yes day for
Every
Remy.
Every day is that is true. Sorry, Remy, you're right. All right.
What is making you happy, though, darling?
Well, I actually am in the works to be doing a podcasting blog where
really?
My expertise about podcasting is now going to be used to help share that knowledge with the masses.
That's fantastic.
And some more details are going to be coming, but I know that Caden's a previous guest who's been on, and I've always mentioned how he's my podcasting buddy, so he's working on a new project that I'm helping with. And part of that is a blog, and so I've been able to start writing about podcasting, which is something I love, obviously. And so being able to know that I'm going to get paid to do what I love is also just going to be awesome.
That's fantastic, and I've already read some of the things you wrote, and they're really good.
Excellent. So we'll be sure to let all of you listeners know how you can find it when it starts coming out. But in the meantime, let's head on over to our Binge and Purge section.
Yes, and luckily, again, we only have binges this week.
Yes, and while it wasn't officially part of the list, I might have guessed, since it was your What's Making You Happy, that she had a movie that Yesterday is also a binge-worthy movie.
Yes, and it's on Netflix.
Yes.
And it's fantastic. And for anybody out there that follows Logo on social media, check out the interview that Jen did with Peppermint and Ben de la Creme, and it's really, really cute. They all dressed as their favorite Jen characters from past movies.
Aww.
There was one from Alias, one from 13 Going on 30, and one from Yesterday.
Excellent. Yes, well, I know that you love your Jen Garner.
I do, because she's a West Virginia girl, and us West Virginia folks stick together.
Yes, exactly. Well, in another binge, also on Netflix, which I only realized the irony that it was on Netflix, is The Last Blockbuster.
Yes, The Last Blockbuster is a documentary detailing the efforts of the very last Blockbuster store in the world to stay open, and the people that have worked there and kept it going.
Yes, and so it was a fascinating documentary. They do tell it like it's edutainment, where it's comedians and famous people and faces that, you know, you won't have any AAA actors going across the stream, but a lot of people, you're like, I've seen them there, or You know, and it was really good, but it was interesting. The rise of the VHS and the rise of Blockbuster, and learning about that is also going to be something that's great for this whole new generation that doesn't understand how it works. But, you know, back in the day of the VHS tape, that was $100. I can't even imagine.
I remember when DVDs were coming out, they were really expensive to begin with. And that's not like, you know, now where they're like, oh, you get a Blu-ray and a DVD and you get the digital download code and it has all these extras and we're going to charge you $26.
Yeah.
No, it was like $35 to $40 from the get-go at the beginning. It was crazy.
And, yes.
But the cheapest place to buy DVDs originally?
Where?
Amazon. And I think that's one of the ways that they...
And it stayed that way.
Yeah.
But yes, the documentary was fascinating, and it is still open. And if we ever find ourselves
In Oregon,
we will be
driving to Bend.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, something that we can enjoy from our couch that doesn't require planning a road trip, because it's in the past,
yes,
is The Irregulars.
The Irregulars, which, from what I understand, is a takeoff on a series called The Baker Street Irregulars, dealing with a group of kids who investigate paranormal happenings in London during the Sherlock Holmes time, that Baker Street is famously the home of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. And so they kind of hire these kids to investigate things for them because it all ties back to a mystery from the past.
Yes, and it is so well done and it's so interesting. You know, one thing that last week we were saying how we love The Toll because it was this unique idea. Having a show about Sherlock Holmes is not a unique idea.
No.
They've done it so many times and this is just one of the fresher takes of it that I've seen. And it's just really engaging. It's twisting and turning already. We're about halfway through.
And what was nice is that Sherlock was, for many episodes, just spoken of
or
barely hinted at.
Yes.
And now he's kind of a tertiary character, but still not the focus.
Yes. And I really like it. So I'm excited to see how it all turns out. But yes,
me
so
too.
Far, so bingey.
Yes. Well, I guess that means that it is time to head on over to our discussion of Downton Abbey.
All righty. Sounds good. Let's head on over. And now, thanks to the podcasting magic, we have teleported across the pond and we are now talking with Miss Ronnie Diamond.
Hello, everyone.
Ronnie, thank you so much for joining us all the way from France.
I've got my baguette and my cheese all waiting.
And yes, and so before we get into Downton Abbey, for our listeners, why don't you explain a little bit about how you know Stephen and how your friendship started?
It's been 84 years.
You're not the old lady from the Titanic, however much you want to believe you are.
84 years. In all sincerity, this was Steve and I went to school together. So many, many, many decades ago now.
Not that many decades ago.
400 years.
Old whore. We met in 1999.
Okay.
I still have some of my original bones.
None of your original cheekbones, though.
That's true.
So the first time I remember Ronnie, it was a Saturday, and we were going over for a Mountaineer football game, which is what everybody did on Saturdays. Mm-hmm. And our friend Dominic Casuccio brought Ronnie along, and Ronnie was trying to behave himself because he was around a whole new group of people and he was very excited about the tailgating part, but not the sports ball part.
Yes. Well, I can understand that.
I've never been one for sport. You understand.
Just the balls.
Well, you have me there.
And from that point on, like, we started seeing more of Ronnie than we did Dominic Casuccio at that point. And
if I recall correctly, your mother had a delicious, freshly baked lemon squares just for me, or so I imagined them to be. And then or so I commandeered them.
Yes.
Then I began to eat them.
Yes.
And from then on, I was happy.
Yeah. And so then any time that I went home for a weekend and I would come back and mom would always send me back with either cherry crunch or lemon squares or something. Ronnie and Monika were real quick to get to my dorm room to see what Mother Martin had sent them. Quotation.
I was going to say, well, I've had Mother Martin's baked goods before and I can certainly understand the need to commandeer them because that happens even now to you when you bring them home.
Yes.
There is always a need to commandeer Mother Martin's good food. Mm-hmm. However, I will have it clearly known that those were particularly signed and addressed to me.
Okay.
With labels.
All right. Well, that is now on
clarity.
Record. Yes.
Yeah. Clarity.
So you love Downton Abbey. Tell us what about the show, like, causes such joy for you.
So I think, well, going back just a little bit, I've always loved the great Victorian era, the Belle Époque, as they call it in France. And it's basically the time between 1871 or after the Franco-Prussian War up to World War One or 1914. And it's at that point in time when Europe was mostly at peace and you see the height of what we now call like the Gilded Age in the United States or the Victorian era in Europe. And it's during this time we're beginning to see a huge change across society. The breakdown of what had essentially been the culture for centuries, really going back to the Conqueror. So it's at this time we're starting to see a huge change in the role that women play in other forms of diversity coming onto the stage, if you will. And it's through the it's this time, whether it be in literature or film, that I cling to most dearly.
I can vouch for that. Downton Abbey, as we've alleged, is a British historical drama TV series set in the early 20th century, created and co-written by Julian Fellowes. And series one begins at the English country estate called Downton Abbey in spring of 1912 with the sinking of the Titanic. Now, I know you feel strongly about the Titanic as well.
That's true, because if you'll recall, Stephen Jay, when we were at school, we'd watch it every weekend with popcorn and all kinds of tasty treats. We'd all have Sunday fun day.
I have seen Titanic more times because of Ronnie. And what was it you always used to say, if you could save one thing from the ship?
Oh, if I could have just saved one dish to add to my glorious collection over here.
It wasn't the people you wanted to save. It was the china.
People are replaceable. China is at the bottom of the sea. I had to tell you, though, you'll find this quite a bit of a surprise, but in 2012, well, not this part, in 2012, I had started a new job, and it was a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And basically, we were creating this agency from scratch, working extremely long and hard hours. This was after the financial crisis, of course.
Right.
But it was during that time I made several close friends, and it wasn't until later on into that year, when season three of Downton Abbey came about, that my new coworkers and friends were asking me continually, have I seen it? I must watch it all the time. Oh, what did you think about it this last week? And we were, at that time in 2012, we were into season three, the first run of season three. And I remember, well, I haven't seen it. I don't know anything about it. I've been living under a rock, as they'd say. And I remember one of my friends, Caroline, saying, that's not possible. You are Maggie Smith. You are Maggie Smith incarnate as the all-American little young German boy. So here we are. And Toaster Strudel. Toaster Strudel.
You are our very own Dowager Countess, and you always have been. Your personality is larger than life. And
yeah, you're not putting on an act for this podcast.
Certainly like not. And I have to say I'm flattered, but it must be known that I immediately went home that weekend and I bought the season one and two on DVD. And you'll know, Stephen Jay, very well that I've never been one to collect DVDs and CDs. I could just take them from you if I needed them that badly.
Yeah, Stephen, true story.
Of course. So I went home, I bought them. And at that point, you could have one and two. And I think it was PBS was still playing and replaying like they do season three. And I caught up and I was... Oh, I can see my past imperfect and my present.
And I was late to the game as well, because I can honestly say that Downton Abbey is the first TV show that I streamed on Netflix.
Oh, wow.
And because Dad had been diagnosed with skin cancer on his back, and the doctor thought they'd gotten all of it, but they wanted to cut a little deeper just to make sure. And so we were up at Moffitt Cancer Center, and it was going to be an all-day thing. And I tried playing video games, I tried reading, but I couldn't stop my mind enough to focus on those things because I was worried. And so I was like, I'll just find something to watch. And I remembered, oh yeah, people had been talking about this Downton Abbey. And so I turned it on Netflix, and I was like, oh my goodness. Like, just the clever writing, the characters, the wit, the sass, and the opulence. Like,
yeah, and you know, it really does reflect that time. If you're not familiar with Downton Abbey yet, or you haven't seen anything by Julian Fellowes, perhaps you have and you don't even remember that you have, or you don't recall it exactly. But Gosford Park, which came out, I think, in the late 90s, is one of his projects. And he's written several books that I'll throw out at the end that I adore, and I think they're fun to read. So if I think one of his projects right now that's been on stop, of course, the coronavirus.
But right.
No help in this. But is The Gilded Age, which will star in it. No, Christine Baranski.
Oh, yeah.
And she will play the equivalency of the powerful Dowager Countess, or the equivalent in our American Gilded Age time.
I can't wait to see that.
Stop, start.
I know. Like, so many things that in entertainment have either been delayed or they've just gone ahead and said, you know what, it's going to cost too much money, that's canceled. And that's unfortunate.
Yes. Well, and
you don't have to tell me. Restaurants and bars and cafes have been closed again since October in France.
Yeah, you definitely have a much stricter lockdown than we do over here.
Yes, especially since we're here in Florida, of all places in the U.S.
So getting into the show, the main storyline that is the thread throughout the whole season is because of the sinking of the Titanic, Lord Grantham, Robert Crowley, has lost his heir, and he only has girls, and because of English law, the girls cannot inherit the title. And
back in the good old days.
And so they have to find another heir. His daughter, Lady Mary, one of my favorites, is upset because somebody that they don't know is going to get what would be her money and her title and her house and all of that. And so a lot of it follows Lord Grantham, Lady Cora, his wife, and Lady Mary and the Dowager Countess as they go along trying to find this heir. What did you think about, like, that back then? Because you're more studied in that era than I am, but I always find that shocking that women weren't allowed to own and have.
And, like, the politics of the way that they would arrange, like, the marriages to make sure, or, like, to try and keep it in the family. What were your impressions of Robert Crowley as a patriarch of the family?
Right, so what... this actually has a name, and it's called primogeniture. And this was something that was common actually until recently, because it was just changed for the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, or Prince William and Princess Kate, and should they have had a daughter first. But it was common, particularly in the UK at this time, that the entire estate, meaning the properties, whether that be an estate in the country, a London house typically, and then maybe a few other estates, plus the money that helped support it, to support that, would all be entailed, or as we could call it more easily, all wrapped up together, entailed. Yeah. And what would happen is it would then be passed on to the male heir. In the case of Robert Crowley, and he puts it best himself in the first season when he explains, he is just a custodian of the estate, of this style of living, in order to be that good custodian, to take care of it, and then to pass it on and to keep it going as it has always been. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Robert and Cora, and that's Lady Cora to you, Steve, so don't get cheeky.
Sorry about that, Lady Cora.
Just so we're clear, we'll stick to formality. So we get to that part where they want, of course, he has to prepare his heir. He has an heir, his cousin, his first cousin, and his cousin's son, Patrick. So just so happens that these two are on the crossing of the Titanic. Naturally, being men, even though first class, they are not saved, and then they drown on the crossing of the Titanic. This throws up into question, what will happen to the entailed estate? Who's it going to go to? Would it be a chimney suite in Surrey? I mean, we don't know to whom this property... We don't know to whom this property and the estate will go. So,
and it's all Lady Cora's money, because
it is Lady Cora's money.
In proper Crowley fashion, they bankrupted the estate prior, and Robert had to marry for money.
That's correct. But he was not alone during this time. It was quite common in the 1880s, 1890s, and as we approach 1900, that a lot of the estates, based off of their money, came in from agricultural mainly. And it was common at this time for many of them to be running out of money. The things were changing. The Industrial Revolution had taken place. So they were getting cheaper goods in from the Americas and whatnot. So they were running out of money. They were still living as they always had, and the money was drying up. In order to flush cash into these estates and to keep the families afloat. Young lords, counts, if we're on the continent, dukes, barons, and whatnot, were going to America, particularly New York, and finding young heiresses and their families, sometimes even very new money, who were very interested in seizing a title, and in doing so would be flushing the estate with cash and probably keep it going for a couple of generations, and would have. Mm-hmm. And it is in this case that Robert and Cora...
Lady Cora.
Well, not to me, because she and I are equals, of course.
Okay.
But for you, as a servant or an official, you'll say Lady Cora, and then we'll leave it at that. And so... that being, but now I digress here. So, and that's where we are. So so we now have two camps develop. Robert wants to be, as he always was, the custodian. He wants to keep the state together. He wants it all together, and he wants it to move to whoever it may be.
Because he sees Downton as larger than himself. It's more than just him. And the family, it is a living, breathing entity all of its own.
Yes. Lady Cora, her daughter Lady Mary, the first of the three girls, and her mother-in-law, Lady Violet, want the intel smashed, broken up, the title be damned, and then, from there, Mary named heiress of all. So right. She would not be able to keep the title other than Lady Mary, which she had from birth and would always have. But she could keep the money and all the estates and everything with it. So it's naturally understandable that Lady Cora, her mother, would be upset about the fact that all of her money has to go to a complete stranger from God knows where.
And it's interesting that whenever they find the heir, so it's Robert's... third cousin once removed. So, like, there's barely any blood at that point.
Yeah.
And he is a lawyer whose father was a doctor. And what I find really interesting is that they all look down upon lawyers and doctors, where in America these days, you've got,
those are, like, the professions to be admired.
They're
for.
Like, oh, he's a doctor. And over there, they're like, oh, he's a doctor.
Well, I think it's really – no, I mean, you're absolutely correct. The thing is it's important to always remember we have to be careful when we place judgments on the past in this sense, because we have normal culture of that time was that members of the aristocracy did not work. Right. Their work was associated with the management and preservation and the traditions associated with the estates.
Correct. And so you've got Matthew Crowley, cousin Matthew, coming into town with his mother, and he is a lawyer. She was trained in medicine during the African War, and he doesn't want to be an aristocrat. He doesn't want Downton to change him. Then you've got Lady Mary, who is angry at all of this, and she doesn't want to be attracted to him. She doesn't want to be kind to him. You know, she'll be civil because that's what her manners and breeding have taught her to do.
Well, wasn't part of it also, like, that they were basically saying, well, the easiest solution is for you to marry him, and then it's all fixed, and, like, the fact that that was kind of arranged, she was like, well, I don't want you to tell me what to do.
And that's Lady Mary always is, if I come to the same conclusion you do, fine, but it needs to be my choice. You will not push this upon me.
Yep.
Seems like somebody else I know.
I do, of all of the characters, Lady Mary's the one that I was like, oh, I get her.
Yes.
That I get. I get the whole thing.
Right. And she, and you know, her biggest complaint from the get-go is, and they're fighting it, right? They all know that the other people the other person is fighting. So Lady Violet, Lady Cora, and Lady Mary are fighting Robert because they want it smashed and he wants it preserved. And they're talking about how they're fighting each other, but they're civil about it. And Lady Mary is most upset about the fact that she feels as though Lord Grantham, her father, Robert, will not fight for her in this.
Exactly. He's the only one that's not defending what she feels is rightfully hers, but also in general, just fighting for her as his daughter.
Exactly.
She doesn't yet understand the love of Downton as a thing where Lord Grantham, as we know, as you said, custodian, she's not there yet in her head. She gets there in several seasons later.
Exactly. there's a very convoluted and path through Narnia that it takes to get there. But one does exist. There is a pathway.
Speaking of identifying with her, I mean, luckily one thing we didn't have to face before our marriage was any of your sex scandals, because I just welcomed them. But, yeah, I mean, poor Mr. Pamuk.
Poor Mr. Pamuk, which it's my favorite line in the show, and it's like Lady Cora says it. The servants say it, and they all refer to him as poor Mr. Pamuk. Poor Mr. Pamuk.
Oh, come on. And he went out with a bang. There are worse ways you can go.
And, oh, that was literal.
And I just found it. That is, I think that storyline is what solidified Downton as something really different for me, because I was, you know, thinking it was going somewhere, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, she had sex and killed him. And I was like, oh my goodness, this really changes the show and turns it into a high society soap opera for real.
Well, yeah. And to think that shenanigans did not occur during that time would be...
I mean, you were there.
Yeah, tell us about it, Ronnie.
We were the Edwardians. I mean, to think that he didn't engage in all this sorts of lecherous activities would just be a complete fantasy. That being said,
yes,
I return back to 2021.
Mm-hmm. Yes. No, and so I found it really interesting that, I mean, of course she's going to turn to Anna, her lady's maid, to help. And then they decide to get her mother involved. And Lady Cora is ashamed and shocked, but she's also saying, yeah, we're going to get the body out of here.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it. We're going to move this body.
Would your mom help you hide your lover's body if I died? Would she move my body with you?
Oh, yeah. Mother Martin would get the shovel. And you see that, right, Ronnie? You would say, if we had to hide a body, Mother Martin would help out.
I was thinking about the insurance money first, and then how we can make sure that everything unfurls in a proper way.
All right. Well, thank you. I'm glad I have all my papers.
No, I definitely see that. I see that for sure. Mother Mom would definitely be there. I mean, but and then you see this too, because Robert, and I often thought, what if Robert had been faced with this? What if they would have brought him into the situation at that moment in time? Mm-hmm. And of course, that couldn't have possibly happened because he wouldn't have had the countenance to deal with it.
No.
But Lady Cora, being an American, mm-hmm. and you'll see this throughout the entire series, she, of course, she's American. There, she has different cultural norms. And one thing at this time, it was very important, especially someone of new money, which she was to, at all costs, the perception must be unsmudged, if you will.
Oh, mm-hmm. Because perception is reality, and that's still a thing today. Like,
so clearly, yeah.
The idea of a scandal or the hint of a scandal,
just as bad as a scandal,
is just as bad as if the scandal was true.
Although you might not know that, seeing all the people in airports these days when they only wear pajamas.
Now, here's...
I think it's trash with money. It's still trash.
Now, what did you feel like the relationship that was building this season between Lady Mary and Matthew, did you feel it being sincere? Did you feel the chemistry?
I totally felt that chemistry because we watch it build. Mm-hmm. We watch it build as the episodes go on. And then we get into it where, of course, Lady Mary's absolutely and 100% against even the thought or the mentioning of, you know, partnering with Matthew. Mm-hmm. But then little by little, we see that Lady Cora thinks that it's a good idea. And then we find out that it wasn't even Lady Cora's great idea. It was Lady Violet's, her grandmother,
right,
who was completely against it at first. Seeing that the intel could not be spashed and absent a lawyer who could actually do it effectively.
Which they never seem to have a decent lawyer.
Correct. But then we finally get to the point where through bumps and starts and nodging, little growths here and there, if you will, we can see finally a dalliance starting to begin as they, you know, twinkle-toe down the primrose path.
Well, I think they respect the other's intellect and wit, and it starts off with them being sparring partners. They both are kind of surprised that, oh, I enjoy chatting with you, I enjoy arguing with you, and I enjoy spending time with you. I didn't see this coming. And they both have that realization without telling the other one, but you can see it both in the way they interact and in their eyes.
Absolutely. And that's the one thing I have to say. And it's not just in season one, and I won't give any sort of details away in case you out there at home haven't had the opportunity to engage in it. But that is something that is absolutely one of the things I absolutely love about the entire series, is that there will be continual character growth and development, which and then, of course, the war will change a lot of that, too. Yep. But you will truly see character growth in Julian Fellowes' work. And I think it's fantastic.
So we talked about Lady Mary. Let's skip over to the other sisters. We have Lady Edith and Lady Sybil. Lady Edith is what's very interesting is Laura Carmichael, who plays Lady Edith. Laura Carmichael is quite lovely in real life.
Oh,
she's
yeah.
beautiful, but they play Lady Edith up as kind of unfortunate looking. The more plain of the sisters, she's definitely the more book smart of the sisters, but she and Lady Mary do not see eye to eye on anything.
And she's the middle child, which has to be said, that can be a critical factor. So, yes, we see from the very beginning, they're always at odds. They're always like, you know, swiping here, swiping there.
Yeah.
There's a great line lady. There are a great line later on into the season one where Lady Mary comes up, or Lady Edith comes up behind Lady Mary and says, oh, it seems he slipped the hook, meaning a guy got away.
Yeah.
And then Lady Mary turns and says, at least I'm not fishing with no bait.
I love that line so much.
And in that vein, you get a sense of their relationship, which only peaks and valleys as time goes on.
Oh, and, you know, they tried to push Sir Anthony Strallen onto Lady Mary, and he's older and he's boring. He's kind.
He's kind
and gentle, but Lady Mary, that's not the guy that you would set up for her. And also, again, she doesn't want it pushed upon her. It's not her choice. But then you have Lady Edith, who I don't know whether it's, well, this is the best that I can do, or I can take this away from Mary and it'll be a victory of mine over her.
I think she's just very cock-hungry because throughout the series, she just goes after any guy with a pulse that walks her way and, like, gives her half a side glance. Like, she's very, like...
Well, she's thirsty.
Yeah, she's a thirsty bitch.
And I can't argue with that.
Because, I mean, she obviously goes after Cousin Matthew. She's like, I'll show you around to all the churches, and then we can do it again. And Matthew's like, how about we bring my mother next time? And which is kind of saying,
no, thank you.
No, thank you. I'd rather not have anything with you. And Lady Edith, because Daisy's an idiot, Lady Edith finds out about poor Mr. Pamuk and the scandal. And because Edith is a horrible person in this season, decides to go ahead and out of sibling rivalry and jealousy and anger, decides to tell the embassy that exactly what happened.
The bang bang.
He died during sex, and then the news starts to get out and besmirch Lady Mary's reputation.
Exactly.
Now, whenever you saw Lady Edith doing that, what were your thoughts? At any point were you like, oh, girl, good for you? Or were you like, how dare you? This is family.
I was enraged of her not wanting to protect the family.
I agree. Yes. I agree. Like, we can fight internally, but I will not set someone from the outside onto the family to hurt some of the family. Like, our fights are our own. No one else needs to get involved.
Which is exactly what she did in riding the Turkish ambassador, mm-hmm. who then... And then we find out it gets to other cousins and other family members. And then at one point it gets back to the Dowager Countess, Dame Maggie Smith. Mm-hmm. And then she confronts Cora about it.
Yep. And like, and Cora's like, it did happen. And Maggie Smith ends up being like, you know what?
I would have protected her too.
Yeah, I don't know if I would have had the strength to do it, but I would have tried. And I respect you for doing it.
And just a little bit of foreshadowing here without giving away the whole tale. In the future, we learn to understand why that may be that she is so understanding.
Absolutely. Which, that was an interesting character development for Maggie Smith as well.
Yeah, yes, totally.
And yes. So Edith starts to fall for Sir Anthony, and they start to develop a relationship to the point where Sir Anthony is going to propose. And Lady Mary has at this point found out that Lady Edith is the one that betrayed her. And Mary, exactly. Mary, in proper Mary fashion, decides to lash out and get revenge. And she did it in such a brilliant way that it can never be traced back to a thing of, well, what do you mean? I didn't do that on purpose. Because she goes up to Sir Anthony and says, oh, you're looking for Edith? Well, she's probably avoiding things because there was a horrible boar that was going to propose to her today. And I hear that he's just the worst. She does such a good impersonation of him. She should be on the stage. And Sir Anthony's like, oh, damn, that's me. And so he tells Edith he's leaving, and Edith is crushed and looks over to Mary across the garden party, and Mary raises a champagne flute, tips it to her, and it's kind of like, hey, Edith, screw around and find out. You just found out. And I loved that in and of itself, that Mary was able to get revenge because in her mind, that was Edith's only man ever. And now I've destroyed the relationship.
Right. And it's even, and you know, that's true. And at that point, what options did Edith have? Mm-mm. Even there was a private conversation going on with Cora and Mary earlier in the season. And Cora says to Mary that she ought to be kind to her sister, Edith, because Edith has less advantages than Mary. And so it is known. And I have to say, you know, it's kind of like she is so, in real life, she's beautiful. She's so beautiful.
Lara Carmichael is gorgeous.
But, you know, Sarah Jessica Parker is beautiful. And then they can also make her look the same way. I think both mm-hmm. of those women are similar in that they are truly beautiful.
Correct.
But just with, you know, the slight of the angle and this and that, they can have them appear just however they'd like.
Exactly. And one of the things I loved when it was in the season finale as well, and they had just come back from season and in London, and Lady Cora turns to Lady Sybil and is like, you should be proud of how you handled yourself during your first season in London. And
AKA her debut.
Yes. And Edith is like, you never say that to me. Oh, don't I? Edith, you were quite helpful.
And it's not as though she's trying to be unkind.
No.
It's just, and that's something that we're probably not as used to today, is blatant honesty.
Yeah.
And just telling people how it is. And I'm sorry that you have to be mollycoddled, or I'm sorry that we have to wrap it around a stem of cotton candy in order to present this difficult information to you. I mean, it's in the same vein as not letting children watch Bambi or things like that. You know, they're just, it's different now than it was 100 years ago. And to be quite frank, during that time, they were just more frank and more specific in their feedback.
Now, we've got Lady Sybil, who is the baby of the family. What are your thoughts on her as a character?
Well, who doesn't love Lady Sybil? Sweet, kind, compassionate.
progressive. Loving.
Mm-hmm. Very progressive. And although her in season two, we see her character progress even more than we could possibly ever imagine.
Right.
We do begin to see glimpses of it at the end of season one. And that is when she starts to see, we start to see her show up in new clothes and new frocks that she had the dressmaker make. It's a new style. And it's looking, it's because, again, this is right before World War One.
Right.
So the styles did not change drastically until we get into the flappers of the 20s.
Right.
And so,
which the show does a really good job of showing later on.
Exactly. And for her to be that avant-garde at that time does say something special.
Now, it also felt like a lot of her storylines were not as, over time, I guess, whenever you look back, Lady Sybil's.
Oh, sorry, I rang for tea, Trudy.
Like, Lady Sybil's caring about the vote isn't going to be one of the major storylines that audiences remember over time. Like, sometimes I feel like Lady Sybil can be the forgotten sister with the forgotten storylines.
Well, yes, and yes, and I do agree with that. But also, I mean, because you bring up specifically the vote.
Uh-huh.
Remember, this was at the time, and great, you know, England had the vote for women before the United States did.
Of course they did.
And, yeah, and they had to be older than 18 at the time, but I think, you know, they did have it before. And so when we see this with the vote and her interest in the vote, and she starts to participate in things like that, and we see her blossom in that direction and become, I hate the word ignorant, but it's true in this sense that she does lose ignorance related to those topics, and she becomes well-informed. And without giving too much away, we could later on down the line, the Dowager Countess makes reference back to this. And I think this is towards the end, middle of season two, the Dowager Countess even makes references to this, as in Lady Gregory, Countess Markievicz, why the Irish rebels so well-born?
And
yes, but so, I mean, I also feel like, I mean, for all the characters and the number of stories that they had go through the season, they had such a huge cast to have so many different stories going on in the six episodes and have them all be so well told.
I mean, we haven't even gotten to downstairs yet.
Well, and that's where we are headed right now. I was going to
say, and you love heading downstairs, so let's get on down there.
Well, let me grab my passport.
So, and Lady Sybil is a good introduction to downstairs because she is helping Gwyn to leave service and become a secretary, which it really humanized Lady Sybil so much where, you know, they're all very civil and friendly to the servants, but Sybil was like, I'm going to help you. We're going to be friends. And she sends poor Gwyn off to live in the North in Game of Thrones after this.
Well, right. So, and remember, and you know, Julian Fellowes is very accurate here. Does this reality, is this a possible reality for this time? Absolutely. But 20, 30, 40 years before that, maids, servants, footmen, not footmen, but maids would turn the other way and face the wall when one of the family were walking by. So things did change and things were changing at that time.
That's really interesting in and of itself.
Yeah, and you see, with Gwyn, because she's so kind, she's so sweet, she has so much potential that just if given a chance, we can also watch her blossom.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, Lady Sybil takes that interest and she helps her. She takes her to job interviews and things like this. But what we really see, too, is another side where with Gwyn, the question is, well, why do you want to leave service? Mm-hmm. Why would you want to leave service? Why do you want to leave me? Because I can. But, you know, and the question comes up, well, we would ask ourselves, well, why aren't her parents supporting this change, right? Well, you know, in her her father, she says, thinks she's got it great where she is, and her mother doesn't want her to get, quote unquote, above herself. And this is the mentality, really, honestly, until a few decades ago, and even still in many cases, what we call the old crab bucket. When somebody starts to do well, the rest of the people want to pull them back down. And in this case, it's just ingrained, century after century, regardless of culture around the world. Don't be better than your others. Don't be better than this. Don't try to improve yourself. And
I mean, you see that with groups of friends and family and things. You know, somebody gets a promotion at work. Are you really happy for them? Or do you wish they were back down on your level? You know, somebody gets a new car. Well, why did they get a new car? Like, you don't, you want to.
Because it's the way God wants it. That's why.
You want to have nice things for your friends and family, but you don't really want them to be nicer than what you have.
Well, and the reason, and therein lies the rub, right? We hang out often and we are with those that are similar to us. And then what does that actually result in? Or what would we call that by any other name, which then just so goes hand in hand with the series? Class.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And one of the...
Speaking of classless, we have the villains.
Yes, we have our two villains, O'Brien and Thomas. O'Brien is Lady Cora's lady's maid, and Thomas is the first footman, and Thomas is also gay. Gay.
Back then, I'm guessing it wasn't really accepted or talked about much.
Well, at that time, you could still go to prison for hard manual labor, as we saw with Oscar Wilde. And he was of the upper echelons as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what it was considered, what are the upper classes for, if not to set an example? He was not setting an example.
and it seems like it wasn't too much of a secret because Mrs. Patmore knew. And
oh, yeah, they know.
Because Daisy, who's an idiot, Daisy's just an idiot. And she falls for Thomas. And Thomas flirts with her just to get back at William, who he hates. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Patmore's like, he's not the boy for you. He's not a ladies' man.
She just doesn't get it.
Yeah. He's an unfortunate soul. And, you know.
A poor, unfortunate soul.
Yeah. And Daisy's like, yeah, you're right. He's too good for me. No, girl, that's not what I'm saying.
Well, that is true, too.
Most everyone was too good for Daisy just because she's that dumb.
I was going to say, at that point, it would have been like, never mind, you're the perfect beard.
She is a scullery maid, for those listening in, and a complete simpleton.
Yes. And that's all that there is to it. Mrs. Patmore was one of my favorites downstairs because of her sass and her one-liners and her humor, but also her heart. I really, really liked Mrs. Patmore. And I was personally worried for her with the whole eyesight storyline.
Now, see, this is something where I would think most of the audience would also be very concerned. They're going to get rid of her. They'll throw her to the wolves.
It's the end.
It's the end for her. We're going to write her out, right? Well, you'd be surprised. Although they didn't have a lot of course, technology and surgeries weren't that advanced. In fact, they really didn't become more advanced until after the First World War I and then into World War II. But she's basically getting cataracts removed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not uncommon, really, for that whole take care of your own mentality to be in place. So I was not surprised that Lord Grantham and Cora, you know, want to pay for the cataract surgery and to, you know, take care of her as much as they can. But I could also see on the other side where people watching this for the first time, giving the thoughts of snobbery and this and that, that they would just throw her to the gutter.
Who was your favorite of the downstairs characters?
Let me think about that. Honestly, I really just love Carson.
I love Carson too, and I love how he is so personally protective of the family. And
he sees them as his family.
Yes. And I think most of them also see Carson as part of their family. Like,
yes.
Lady Mary especially sees him as a second father.
Absolutely. He was there when she was born. You will see this as, you know, the series develops and the plot thickens, that their relationship is as strong as possibly can be. Mm-hmm. And he has been there her entire life. They're very close. They're very much alike, just like she's very much like her grandmother. Right. So the three of them are usually in the same camp and the same school of thought when it comes to anything. And as it was often said then, and it's mentioned in the series, but said then in reality as well, the servants are often more conservative than the families. So mm-hmm. take that into consideration as well.
And to go back to O'Brien and Thomas, they immediately hate Bates.
Immediately.
Yes.
Okay, no, I have to change my answer. My favorite person downstairs is Anna. I agree completely. When we first started, it was the first picture that came into my mind, and I don't often think of downstairs, but Anna is that one special character, just nothing but love and positive energy, moonbeams exude from her body. So she's fantastic. That's my favorite.
Yep, she's absolutely kind.
And then Carson.
Yeah, and then I mean the way she and Bates have their relationship develop, and she comes to his rescue and stands up for him so much, just really cute the way that their love develops.
And it's Thomas is stealing all around the house. He's stealing money. He's stealing wine, and he gets caught multiple times and keeps trying to blame it on Bates because he doesn't feel Bates deserves the position of valet because he wanted it.
Exactly. And the reason why he wanted it was because when the first episode of season one is opening, we see Bates on a train on his way to Downton. And we, at that point, of course, we don't know. That's at the same time we're finding out the Titanic has just sunk and so on and so forth. But when we get when Bates arrives at Downton Abbey, he immediately is judged by all the others because he has an issue with his leg. And it's a war injury. He has an injury that was left over from the Boers War in South Africa. And that is an injury for which he's judged by all the downstairs staff.
And a lot of the upstairs people.
Well, of course. And until they find out downstairs anyway that he got that injury while he was in battle with Lord Grantham. Mm-hmm. So they are comrades in arms. And then we see a little bit of the thawing of the ice.
And that honestly makes Bates kind of our point of entry character, point of view character with the show.
Yep. So,
because in a lot of things, you have somebody moving into the apartment building or starting at the company in TV shows so that you have somebody that
everyone else gets to explain this is how it works.
So with Thomas, in this case, because he's coming to serve as his lordship's valet, there was a former valet who had left, who had retired, and Thomas had been the substitute during this time. And it's for this reason that he's embittered. He wanted to stay on as valet. And now why is he being passed over for Long John Silver, as he puts it?
Yeah.
Yes. And then, of course, like a good queer, he recruits his old hag in to help him with his scheming.
Yeah. And
she is a piece of work back in the knife box, Miss Shaw.
O'Brien, it doesn't have a lot of redeeming qualities throughout most of season one. You don't really have a reason to root for her as a character. You may enjoy her performance, but she's not somebody you associate with or you are endeared to because she's only nasty to people. She is haughty and antagonistic to people.
I was like, and then at the end, I mean, talking about geriatric pregnancies from before we hit record, I mean, she ended up being the one who hurt Lady Cora.
Yeah, I mean, And that was an interesting scene where thank you. That was an interesting scene where she had felt that she was about to be fired by Lady Cora because she misunderstood that Cora was helping Lady Violet find a new lady's maid, and so she thought that Cora was looking for a replacement for her, and so she was feeling hurt and left out. And she had been feeling the sting throughout the season. And so Lady Cora drops the soap. It breaks in two. And originally she said, careful, the soap fell, but it went under the tub. And then O'Brien moves it. And she's like, I'll show her. But right at the last second, O'Brien's like, this isn't who you are. You're not the person to hurt somebody else.
It's and, just too little too late.
Yeah. And she goes back to say, look out, my lady. But it is too late. And Lady Cora slips, falls. And something we haven't talked about is Lady Cora had gotten pregnant. And with
a
potential heir. And this soap thing causes her to lose the baby. And it would have been a male heir that would have solved all their problems.
And as I say to my husband, Brent, on a daily basis, you can't unring a bell.
No.
And in this, so we don't even truly see her. And if she, and that was really, that's really for the individual audience member to decide for him or herself. Mm-hmm. Does she make up for that in season two? And that's a question to watch for.
You're absolutely right. And you can see it
and
starting.
Can she? I don't know.
Yeah, and
we'll have to have you back for series two.
Yes, we'll have to do a series two. But the can she is a better question than does she try? Because you can honestly see, even during the garden party, she's trying really hard to take care of Cora. Even in her heart, when she still thinks she's about to be fired, until Lady Violet comes and says, you know, Cora's been helping me try to find a new lady's maid. And then O'Brien realizes that all the anger and everything she felt was misguided and undeserved. And that mm-hmm. Cora was her defender and was never going to get rid of her. And I think that that right there, a combination of the, oh God, what have I done? And my actions weren't necessary to begin with, is something that changes O'Brien on a deep level, I think. I think it's it's the beginning of the change for O'Brien.
Well, precisely. And we see this constantly throughout, even with Robert, or Lord Grantham, that is. He's not a fan of O'Brien. He would be quite pleased if his wife, Lady Cora, were to dismiss this lady's maid and find another one.
You won't hear any complaint from me.
So, but it is Lady Cora who is her staunchest advocate and her biggest cheerleader.
Yep. I mean, Cora was like, if we are to be friends. And she does, I think, the way she talks to O'Brien and relates to O'Brien, I do think Lady Cora does consider them friends, the same way Mary considers Anna her friend.
But there still were lines that weren't crossed. And decorum, etiquette, mm-hmm. and the social way of the workings of it all were how they were, and you have to play within that role. And she overstepped the mark in that first part of season one when she's discussing how she disapproves of Matthew Crawley.
Yes.
To which Lady Cora overhears and becomes upset, which then leads and all the rest.
So now let's move on to the thing I've saved for last. You appearing on screen, the Dowager Countess. Tell me why you love the Dowager Countess.
I think first and foremost, I think the reason why I think the reason why most people like her and this character is she can say what she wants. She can say it in a time when, and in a place, of course, where you had to certainly filter everything that you said. Mm-hmm. She says what she wants. She gets her point across. She says it with wit.
I like that she gets away with it.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, that's in part due to her age as well. You can get away with more, as they say.
Yes. And her status and her age definitely play into her favor with getting to say whatever she wants, and people, you know, treating her with respect and her being revered and feared because she has a sharp tongue.
Exactly. Well, precisely. And, you know, it's not as though she just comes out and starts yelling at someone. It's not as though she just comes across and says, you know, starts cursing left and right. Of course, that's what peasants of today always do. But at that time, that's not what one would do. It's certainly not of her class. And the one example of this is at the beginning of season two, and I won't give too much away, but they're getting into World War I, and she leaves the Dower House to go over to Downton Abbey. And she's there, and she says, "Robert, dear, you wouldn't mind if I arranged the flowers, do you? Cora's flowers always look more appropriate for a first communion in southern Italy." So we have the zingers left and right, but it's done at, I would say it's done in a special manner, only and specifically tailored to her.
Well, and that's like when Lady Cora and the Dowager are talking about how they can help Mary and working on the intel. And Lady Cora says, "Are we to be friends then?" And the Dowager says, "We are to be allies," which I believe is a great deal better.
Exactly.
And what are some of your favorite of the Dowager's lines in season one?
When upon her meeting Mrs. Crawley and Matthew for the first time, they meet in the grand hall of Downton Abbey, and Mrs. Crawley, Matthew's mother, walks forward and says, "What shall we call each other?" And the Dowager Countess says, "Well, we could always start with Mrs. Crawley and Lady Grantham."
Yes, I like that.
And one that I always associate with you is when Matthew says he's going to be working during, you know, working a job, and Lord Grantham's like, "I want to show you the estate and how things run around here." And Matthew's like, "Well, I always have the weekends." And what does the Dowager say?
"What is a weekend?"
For some reason, I always associate that with you.
And you are correct in doing so, my dear. And there are so many in that scene, season one, and so many good ones. I have actually some of my favorite ones are in season three and season five, which we will get to hopefully at one point. But that one has so many. They're all at dinner. I think it's for the second or third time. And they're talking about the hospital and how Mrs. Crawley might be interested in, you know, volunteering or helping out with the hospital, given that her late husband and late father were both doctors and she trained as a nurse during the war.
Yeah.
And Matthew says, "Well, who pays for that?" And the Dowager Countess puts down her fork and knife and says, "Oh, good, let's talk about money," which is never done.
It's never done.
Among the English upper class.
Yeah. And Mrs. Crowley...
That's why they ran out of it, because they didn't talk about it.
Mrs. Crowley and the Dowager have a rivalry all season. And
absolutely.
And for a good bit throughout the show where they have this rivalry that lends itself towards a friendship. But, you know, and unfortunately, because I was always Team Dowager, Mrs. Crowley seems to get one up on her from time to time.
Indeed.
And finally, the Dowager gets one back at Mrs. Crowley, and she goes, "Well, put that in your pipe and smoke it."
"Your quarrel is with my daughter, Lady Rosamond. So put that in your pipe and smoke," which was a saying at that time. That, again, another way that I just love Julian Fellowes is, for the most part, everything is exact. Nothing is said unless it was already said or had been said in using those sorts of phrases or idiomatic expressions we still say that today. But, you know, that is a great example of character development and growth with these two women as they evolve throughout the series.
Yeah.
And it's a fantastic thing to behold, I have to say.
Because I was going to say, because while at first it almost started off mildly antagonistic, it turns into them kind of both pushing each other to grow and be better.
Exactly. Clearly, they do that. And it's nice to see. It's really nice to see.
Well, and I...
Unlike you two, who egg each other on to be worse and worse.
Yes, it's nice to see.
Vulgarity is no substitute for wit, Steve.
I totally forgot where I was going at that point.
I'm flattered.
So, darling, what are your final thoughts on Downton Abbey Season 1? Because this is your first time to sit down and watch it all the way through with no interruptions for season one.
On purpose, yes. Yes.
Oh, well, no, this is probably the 100th or 200th. Oh, are you talking to him or to
I
me?
Was because talking to him.
Well, you know, this darling can mean not anything.
Yes. Well, this
people always call me darling.
Yes, well, that's a different. That's more of a darling.
So, Stephen, my love.
Yes.
This is your first time sitting down watching it all the way through because though I was a fan, you came in later.
Yes, and again, I'm not typically into period pieces. I do find that rewatching the first season, it was.
He says it's a pity.
It is a pity. It's a sign of my low intelligence from what I hear. But I liked watching season one to see where it all kind of starts, but I definitely feel like the as they develop the characters better in the future seasons, like it gets more interesting and engaging. So, you know, hang tight. If you liked this a little bit, hang tight because it gets better and better in my opinion.
I'm glad to hear you say that because, you know, the number one series right now, it seems, or that I read a few weeks ago that it was Bridgerton.
Oh, yeah, Bridgerton. Yes, loved Bridgerton.
And it is a fantastic series. And it's really the same sort of series. This is all, well, I think it's a little bit closer to Jane Austen, if you will. This is a correct. Little bit Downton Abbey's more, is, I think, closer to the whole Henry James, Edith Wharton sort of group, which are my favorite. But if you like Bridgerton, you will like Downton. And I would offer that it's great to give Downton a chance because finally and eventually, and still keeping with the times, you will see more diversity. You will see more inclusion, which I think is one of the reasons why Bridgerton was so popular and is so popular and will be for quite a while.
Well, and the thing I loved about Bridgerton is that they really did colorblind casting where you could be black, white, or any
Asian,
race.
Anything yeah. in between.
And they did, and it wasn't a topic of conversation because they just yeah. treated it as if everyone was the same, which we know back then that, you know, no one of color would have been the queen or.
Well, you know, and this is what this is actually kind of interesting. I often wonder, and I know we won't have the time this time, and it's certainly a very deeper conversation, but should be had nonetheless, is how many decisions in the past would it had to really been made in order for it to been kind of like Bridgerton, not to go off on a tangent, because I will offer that it is thought to be that Queen Charlotte was part black.
Right.
And it is also clearly known that Pushkin, who was a noble in Tsarist Russia, his grandfather was 100% black, if you mm-hmm. will. So that is not as though there wasn't diversity in there at that time. So I have often wondered myself, what decisions along the way during this blip of history, when you think of how old the earth is, would have to been made for it to be more like Bridgerton? And actually probably not that many.
You're right.
You're right.
And if you could, like, sum up your final thoughts on season one and looking into season two, go for it.
War makes early risers of us all.
Yes, and so with that said, if you haven't watched it in a while and want to rewatch it now, or if this has inspired you to check it out, you can not only watch it on Amazon Prime with your Prime subscription, but it is available on Peacock, which I believe is now Paramount
Plus. Nope. Peacock is different. Peacock is the NBC streaming service.
Okay. There's so many streaming services now, I get them confused. But it's on Peacock for free, or if you have Amazon Prime, which most people do, it's free there as well.
Peacock? Isn't that what they used to call you at university? Oh, Peacock.
I do declare.
And I decline.
Ronnie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you.
I'm
flattered to be remembered.
Well, from time to time, we do remember you.
Yeah, we try and forget, but we can't.
I know. It's like that STD that won't go away.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us more about that, dear. You seem to be such an interesting author.
You evil whore.
Thank you. No, really. I must go.
And I hope that you will join us again for a future episode, whether it's about Downton Abbey Season 2 or any other movie that brings you joy that you want to share with the world.
Yes.
I'd be happy to. I adore providing guidance. Yes.
And until then, Ronnie, stay happy. You're still here, which is great, because there's something we probably forgot to mention this episode.
That is correct. Each episode, as we're discussing movies, music, and games, there's a good chance we've used a small clip or two from the original source material.
Yes, and those clips are not ours. We do not own the rights to any of the music or clips. They were used to help solicit a discussion to appreciate the original source material.
And with that, if you are still listening, you likely really appreciate our material as well.
I mean, how could you not? And if you've enjoyed this episode, then you should also ask yourself, when's the last time I told a friend to check out A Lifetime of Happiness?
If your answer was not today, well, it should be.
Yes, so go tell your best squirrel friend about our podcast today, and don't forget to subscribe or follow us wherever you're listening to get new episodes each Wednesday.
Stay happy.